Millions of people across the United States are either on the road to visit relatives or shopping for turkeys and other trappings to celebrate Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was first proclaimed by Governor John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony way back in 1637. Then, following the Civil War, author Sarah Josepha Buell Hale is credited with popularizing the idea of Thanksgiving, and she has become known as the grandmother of Thanksgiving. Now, Thanksgiving was declared a national holiday in 1863 by President Lincoln. The holiday takes place nationally on the fourth Thursday in November. Now, in the novel, in Buell Hale's novel, Northwood, she argued that establishing a nationwide Thanksgiving celebrating would help bring the country together amid growing division. Now, we have to keep in mind the historic context of her novel, the growing threat of the U.S. Civil War between the Union and the Confederacy, a fight really about slavery. And Hale's idea of Thanksgiving was to try to unite people. However, it was only limited to white people and explicitly excluded black people. In fact, she openly advocated for the removal of free black people from the United States, even writing a book called Liberia, named after the West African country of Liberia, that portrays the American colonization society as in a positive light. Now, the American Colonization Society was established in 1816 by Robert Finley of New Jersey to encourage and support the migration of free African Americans to the continent of Africa. Now, you may have some thoughts about that. I mean, if somebody offered a number of us a ticket and some reparations right now and said, well, you could either go back to Africa or to the Caribbean, some people may, in fact, pick that up. But in recent years, Thanksgiving has also become associated with eating turkey. So why turkey? Those poor turkeys. Because in the colonies, they gathered wild fowl and turkeys, part of the hunt for fowl. And colonist William Bradford wrote in his book of Plymouth Plantation that Native Americans hunted wild turkey. And he, dig this, Alexander Hamilton once said, quote, "No citizen of the U.S. shall refrain from turkey on Thanksgiving Day." So the eating of turkey was in part justification of the fictional story of Native people, Indigenous people, and colonists just getting along so happily, sitting down, eating turkey, giving thanks together. And there's even an ongoing tradition whereas U.S. presidents pardon turkeys, and Trump did his bit, pardoning turkey yesterday. And the first Thanksgiving turkey on record was pardoned in 1963 by John F. Kennedy, who received a 40-pound turkey with a sign around its neck that read, "Good eating, Mr. President." I'm sorry, all you vegans up there that are getting increasingly upset listening to this. Since then, major poultry companies use marketing to closely associate turkeys with Thanksgiving, making it a staple dish of the holiday. But what is the real story of Thanksgiving? What was the original intent of the holiday? Why are Native Americans saying that Thanksgiving is a day of mourning? We're going to hear a clip all about that. But before we hear the clip, I'd like to welcome in studio, really delighted, Larry Smith, who is a member of the Lumbee Nation, co-producer and co-host of American Indian Airwaves, one of the longest running Indigenous public affairs radio programs. He is an adjunct faculty member at Cal State University Long Beach in the Department of Film and Electronic Arts, and his academic interests includes Indigenous media policy and sovereignty, the federal Indian and communication law, media democracy, decolonization methodologies, propaganda and censorship in the United States mass media landscape. Well, I've been trying to get you in here on this show for a while, Larry, so thank you for coming in. It took Thanksgiving to bring you in.
Hello, thank you, Margaret, and I'd like to acknowledge the people of the land, the Tongva, Gabarino, the Tataviam, the Chumash, and to the south of here, the Wanino and the Hachiman peoples. glad to be here.
All righty. Thank you. Thank you for that. What we're going to do now is to go to a clip and, you know, that gives us some background about what really happened and what we all have to pause and think about.
The Thanksgiving America celebrates on the last Thursday of November was proclaimed by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1637 to honor a massacre of indigenous peoples. The governor wrote that for the next 100 years, every Thanksgiving Day ordained by a governor was in honor of the bloody victory, thanking God that the battle had been won. The first Thanksgiving meal in 1621 was no fairy tale story between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoag, Pequot, and Narragansett people. And in fact, in October of 1621, 1 year before Tisquantum, a.k.a. Squanto, died, when the Pilgrim survivors of the first winter on Turtle Island, a.k.a. America, the Pilgrims, who had a miserable crop that year, invited a native named Massasoit to their meal. Massasoit followed the indigenous tradition of equal sharing and invited many from his nation. Much of the food brought to that meal was provided by the natives, as they had much more of a bountiful harvest that year. There was no turkey, no squash, no cranberry sauce, or pumpkin pie. The first meal was in essence the beginning of the end. And in 1637, members of the Pequot Nation gathered to celebrate the Green Corn Festival. 700 men, women, and children from the Pequot Nation came together to celebrate, and as they were sleeping in the hours just before the sun rose, the English Pilgrims surrounded and massacred all of them, shooting and beating those that confronted them and burning the rest. After the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children, the next day, the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving and celebrated the killing of the Pequot peoples. Pilgrims fed off the momentum of their victory and continued to slaughter indigenous men, women, and children. A second Thanksgiving feast was had after another massacre of the Pequot peoples in Stamford, Connecticut. In 1777, all 13 of the United States colonies held Thanksgiving celebrations, a continuation of the first celebration in 1637. In 1789, President George Washington declared November 26 a National Day of Thanksgiving. And on October 3, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln finally made it official with a Thanksgiving proclamation, declaring Thanksgiving a national holiday. Thus, you can see that the American Thanksgiving holiday we know today is indelibly tied to the first Thanksgiving in 1637, which celebrated the massacre of millions of indigenous people.
That is quite something. And we want to thank Irene Montoyas for putting that together. Irene is also part of the KPFK family, volunteering with our newsroom, and also part of the Poor People's Campaign, the Los Angeles Steering Committee of it. And that's where I first heard her read this, actually, at our meeting this past Sunday. And I'll have to say, Larry, there were a lot of wet eyes, including mine, after this, the idea that the first Thanksgiving was a celebration of a massacre.
It was. That's not everything that happened. Actually, under Stiles, Standish Miles, who is basically the captain, right, of the plantation, he ordered the massacre of the Pequots while they were conducting their green corn harvest ceremony. But they actually surrounded the longhouse in which they were conducting the ceremony. They set it on fire. So of those 700 people that were massacred, those that didn't burn to death as they fled the longhouse, they actually shot them, stabbed them, and killed them as they fled the burning longhouse. And that's the story that nobody ever hears about. And the other story that, or the other part of that story, which is rooted in the history of this country, is the role that religion plays. And I think that's important, that the Puritans, right? We're separatists. Some of them refer to themselves as saints, others as purists, if you will. They viewed indigenous peoples as non-human beings. They were objectified, dehumanized. They were less than. And so in their mind, the killing of indigenous peoples was doing God's will.
And that's connected to these papal bulls that are still have not been rescinded. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. I mean, the papal bulls takes us back to the Vatican, you know, in 1453 and then 1452 and 1493. And the Vatican was the international theological judicial power, if you will, on Mother Earth. And the church issued two papal bulls basically justifying colonists, European countries, right to discover quote-unquote new lands, right, and then to conquest those lands. And so for indigenous peoples within Africa, they were the involuntary participants in the executors using the papal bulls, the legal theological justification for what I would refer more aptly as theological fascism, in beginning that process of colonizing indigenous peoples within the continent of Africa and committing nefarious intergenerational acts of genocide. And then that later, right, comes over here to the Western Hemisphere. And what's so, and so those two papal bulls are the legal and theological instruments for colonists to come in and quote unquote discover and conquest indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations lands. And those papal bulls are codified in the U.S. Supreme Court watershed court case, Johnson v. McIntosh in 1821. And that court case, along with two other court cases, are cited in every U.S. Supreme Court case that directly and indirectly pertains to indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations. And there are well over 5,000 court cases that directly and indirectly apply to indigenous peoples. And that corpus of law is more aptly referred to as a form of juridical imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite something as people are sitting down and I understand people want to see their families and they travel long distance of families and they want to get together and give thanks for all good things that have happened to them, their loved ones during the year. But we really have to remember, I mean, the idea of a holiday beginning to give thanks for a massacre of 700 men, women and children is really hard to comprehend. I mean, for example, Romero and I were down in Haiti covering the massacres, a series that have happened beginning in La Saline there. And the idea that then a national holiday in Haiti would be established to, you know what I mean, to give thanks for the fact this massacre has happened. We have to put it in perspective. And also that the pre-contact indigenous population in the Americas is said to be as high as 112 million people in 1492, this according to scholars. But by 1650, the figure had declined to less than 6 million people. So this is all part of what you're talking about, Larry.
Absolutely. And today, you know, if you want to use the U.S. Census as a reference, indigenous peoples make up about 2% of the entire American population. Now, that's indigenous peoples within the politically defined borders of the United States. So there are indigenous peoples from elsewhere that now live here and call that home. And that's not part of that 2%. But I think what the mythology of Thanksgiving rooted in genocide, rooted in forms of hatred, rooted in the diminishment of diversity, cultural diversity and biodiversity. So, you know, you were talking about the turkey, right? And the pardoning of the turkey. Well, one of the effects of this holiday is the colonial mono-industrialization of our food system. And so if you want to talk about, you know, indigenous turkeys from the East Coast, there was over 14 species of indigenous turkeys. But
wow.
but one has been commodified and industrialized and is mass produced in these concentrated animal feed operations that most Americans, you know, purchase their turkeys from. And so that has diminished to the biodiversity of this relation, right? Turkeys. And you can say the same thing with other parts of our food system, or what Americans think of as part of our food system. So whether it be squash, yeah. whether it be cranberries, all those crops have been industrialized, you know, with biotech industry. They've come in, they've destroyed or dominated these ecosystems in order, like with the cranberries, in order to industrialize this monocropping system specifically to provide for Americans when they celebrate this mythological meal on Thanks But No Thanks Day.
Yeah, and, you know, showing really the interrelationship with the holiday, you so beautifully broke it down with the attack on the environment and the attack on, and I love the idea of turkeys being a relation, and I know among indigenous people in this country and in so many parts of the world where we do think of other living things that are not human beings, as we are related from the turkeys to the trees, you know, to the four-leggeds, as we call it.
Yeah, and so, you know, that notion of a day of mourning, it's just not the ancestors of the involuntary participants in this quaint term settler colonialism.
Yeah.
It is the destruction and the loss of life of all relations, the two-legged, the four-legged, the air, the sea, the plants, and the animals. And if you just look
at... And this is the crisis we're facing right now.
Exactly. And so if you just look at indigenous peoples today, indigenous peoples live in that have some remnants of their traditional homelands left. They live in some of the most biodiverse regions on Mother Earth. And so as indigenous peoples are, you know, systematically being killed off, and I don't mean just physically, but I also mean, you know, culturally, that the colonial conditions are so entrenched in our daily lives that it controls what we do, how we think, and those thoughts and actions, right, support a colonial way of life as opposed to a traditional way of life, that as we are killed off, so is the biodiversity of the land.
Yeah, and I remember in high school actually being taught that, well, no point including indigenous people, Native Americans, into statistics because they're going to be extinct. Absolutely. I mean, the idea that you're talking that they're going to be extinct, I think, like by 1980 or something like that is just is just outrageous. But we also have to remember when we talk about poverty in the U.S., when we talk about police abuse, indigenous people overall are the most impoverished community in the Americas. I mean, some people look at some of the tribes that are doing gaming and saying, well, those people over there, they're making money. That is not the vast majority of indigenous people. The highest suicide rate among teenagers, indigenous people, and indigenous women, like the black women in South LA, street women being killed and disappeared as though their lives absolutely have no value and referred to as no humans involved. But I want to, you're going to have to come back, Larry, because one of the things I do want to just mention briefly here is I got a press release from the Poor People's Campaign entitled Apache Leader Prepares to Die in Order to Protect Sacred Land in San Carlos, Arizona. And this is the Oak Flat. And I think we do have a short clip, do we, on Oak Flats? Could we do that right now?
Right below us, right where we're sitting down, where I'm standing, they're going to go a mile deep, and they're going to dig a big hole that's equivalent to 1,400 cowboy stadiums, if you can imagine that. A lot of times when you take on these fights, you think, you know, nobody knows that we're here. Nobody knows they're going to dig a big hole in our backyard.
Who's going to help us out? Well, the people here that you see here today, all these people here, native and non-native, are here to show you they support you and you're not alone. So go home when you leave here today and say, you know, we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of supporters out there that love us and they care about us and they care about the earth like we do.
And this is just going to keep happening. They're going to keep coming and keep coming. The Hmong people are going to keep coming and taking these sacred sites one at a time, unless we can all come together and figure out how to stop them.
Now, therefore, I, Terry Rambler, chairman of the San Carlos Apache tribe, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the amended constitution and bylaws of the tribe, do hereby proclaim this day, Oak Platte Day, the day we fight to take back Oak Platte. I call upon all nations, tribes, natives, and indigenous people, and everyone throughout the world to join with us to pray in accordance with our own faith and conscience for the blessing of Oak Platte, for its protection, for its safety, and for our Creator's continuing guidance, grace, and protection, so that Congress may repeal the act and so that we can take back Oak Platte. In witness whereof I have hereunto set my signature, together with the leaders present, the 7th day of February in the year of our Lord, 2015.
All righty. So there we had some background. Oak Platte, a very, very sacred place for the Apache Nation. And a background of this, apparently, Senator John McCain, clearly, he added a last minute rider back in 2014 to a defense spending bill, giving resolution copper rights to dig beneath Oak Platte and mine copper ore located thousands of feet below the surface. Now, Larry, this area is known as a very, very sacred site. And we had also been covering the controversy about the building of a telescope in Hawaii on Mauna Kea, which is again, a very, very sacred site. And what people don't get, it's like the equivalent of, I don't know what, building, you know, tearing down the Vatican and doing some mining underneath it.
Right.
You know, so tell us a little about, because this isn't only the Oak Platte struggle is what happening right now, but we know even here for the local nations in Southern California and throughout the Americas, this is a ongoing battle.
Yeah, and even back home in the Carolinas and Virginia, we're fighting Atlantic Coast Pipeline, right? A 660-mile natural gas pipeline, which they want to expand another couple hundred miles so they can export the gas out of the Charleston port in South Carolina. And so, you know, as indigenous peoples, you know, that we are place-based peoples. And again, going back to that notion of relationality in our traditions and the idea that everything is sacred. And so anytime there's a threat to the land, there's, you know, this development by companies, it is a destruction. It is an annihilation. It is an eradication, not just of sacred sites, but every cultural aspect of our traditional ways of being that's connected to that land. So it's so much more than just the destruction of a sacred site. It is also the permanent loss of everything culturally that's connected to that land based on our oral traditions and our creation stories. So when that land's gone, you might, if the stories survive and are passed down intergenerationally, the means for cultural expression to live and breathe the culture die.
Yeah, and also in talking with some of the women who are active with the Indigenous Environmental Network, they really lament that with the waters being polluted, but also a lot of the healing herbs and plants that are traditionally used in the community and also in ceremony, that they become contaminated, and that this fundamentally is a crisis. And I also read that for the native people in up north across the alleged border, who have these ice boxes where they store, you know, meat and other things for the when the whole community is having ceremony, and then individual families have ice boxes that are dug in the permafrost. And what is happening now because of global warming, that they go into the ice box and there's water at the bottom. Yeah. I mean, the thing is melting. The food is spoiling. So, I mean, this is having a devastating impact.
And I think the other, you know, part of that conversation too is that we need to acknowledge, and you kind of alluded to this in talking about indigenous peoples here in what we know as Los Angeles County, but California indigenous peoples up the coastline where the Alta Spanish mission system was created. That was a torrential system of genocide perpetuated against California indigenous peoples. And it's no coincidence that those survivors do not have a land base today. And so these other, you know, these other struggles, you know, indigenous nations that are federally recognized have some land base where there's a, you know, this the struggle on the grassroots level. But for federally and state recognized indigenous peoples that have no land base, it's always a struggle because you're always living in every space in exile. And so when you
exile in your own land,
and it goes back to being place-based people, and to take it back to where we started our conversation with the Puritans, they were all about the land, gold, God and glory, right? And all about the dispossession of indigenous peoples' lands and exterminating indigenous peoples. And I think that is why it's so crucial that Americans not believe the propaganda that it functions as a central axis of their civic identity as Americans, that this propaganda regarding, you know, the myth of Thanksgiving is so embedded in people's psyche, their sense of identity, in the culture, that we need to decolonize that. People need to think about living differently. Right? They need to think about thinking differently. And that means having relationships with everything, with each other, with the plants, you know, with the animals. And people should acknowledge, you know, the mourning of our ancestors that were involuntary participants in genocide. And people should understand whose lands they live on and the living history of the people's lands that they occupy.
So well said, and deal with the cognitive dissonance. I know it's hard for people to think that you're living in a place where there was mass slaughter, mass genocide.